The Guardian.
It's Wednesday, April the 16th. I'm Belinda Rhodes. On today's podcast, Gordon Brown is down on Wall Street today, but is it a bad time to be away from home?
He talked about how he, the British Prime Minister, is best placed to bring together the United States and Europe.
More pressure on world leaders to take action over the global food price crisis.
We have to examine the biofuel issue very carefully to make sure it does not exacerbate two very important development challenges of poverty alleviation and hunger.
And American Bill Bryson tells us why we should try harder to keep Britain tidy.
Litter, as you will know already, is a big problem all over the country.
First, the news headlines and a look at the morning papers with Sandy Waugh.
The Pope has arrived in Washington on his first visit to the United States and will meet the President at the White House today. He was greeted by a cheering crowd and will go on to the United Nations in New York and visit Ground Zero. On his flight over, he admitted to reporters that he was deeply ashamed by sexual abuse scandals in the US Catholic Church. Also in the United States today is the British Prime Minister Gordon Brown. On Wall Street, he'll tell bankers they must soon reveal all their financial losses to help end the global credit crunch. That follows his meeting with British bankers yesterday. There'll be more on his visit later in Guardian Daily. The Home Secretary, Jackie Smith, will announce today that an extra 300 police will move into fighting terrorism. They'll also concentrate on dealing with radicalisation in immigrant communities. But the Guardian reports today that the surge in immigrants from Eastern Europe has not led to an increase in crime. A police study shows that in spite of press reports, crime in the Polish, Romanian and Bulgarian communities is no higher than in the British population. The low-cost airline EasyJet has broken advertising rules, says the Advertising Standards Authority. They promised a 25% discount on all routes at Easter, but the authority says some passengers would have ended up paying more. And there's a new warning for drinkers and smokers from medical researchers today. Heavy drinkers and smokers are likely to develop Alzheimer's much earlier. And among today's papers, The Guardian warns that Gordon Brown's big trip to the US will be overshadowed by the Pope. The Financial Times says the PM was warned by bankers here that new mortgages might totally dry up unless the government intervened. The Telegraph and the Mail give their front pages to a warning that taking vitamin supplements may actually do you harm and bring about premature death. The Mirror highlights the death of a middle-aged British soldier in Afghanistan. 51-year-old Gary Thompson, who had five daughters, was killed by a roadside bomb. Finally, The Guardian again reports that England rugby coach Brian Ashton is likely to resign today as the former captain Martin Johnson takes over. More on the day's stories and breaking news at guardian.co.uk.
The timing of Gordon Brown's trip to the United States may not prove to be auspicious. As he departed yesterday for talks on the global credit crisis, the Prime Minister's popularity amongst the public and his own colleagues was looking decidedly shaky. Mr. Brown departed amidst a chorus of criticisms from members of his own party. But for now, at least, Mr. Brown has turned his attention to matters across the pond. Political correspondent Nick Watt is travelling with him.
Well, it's going to be a three-day visit to the United States for Gordon Brown. He'll be visiting New York, where he kicks off his trip today. He's going to be taking part in a debate at the United Nations Security Council on Africa, and particularly what more can be done for peacekeeping operations there. And then he'll be meeting financiers on Wall Street to discuss the global financial crisis. Tomorrow, he'll be heading to Washington for a meeting with President Bush at the White House, and he will also be holding meetings with the three presidential candidates, that's John McCain, Hillary Clinton, and Barack Obama. And then on Friday, the Prime Minister will be heading off to Boston to make a major keynote foreign policy speech at the John F. Kennedy Presidential Library.
And there are some interesting articles in the papers today about an interview that Mr. Brown gave CBS. Tell us more about that.
That's right. The Prime Minister did an eve of trip interview with the CBS, and he used some very interesting language in that interview. He talked about how he, the British Prime Minister, is best placed to bring together the United States and Europe after the divisions over Iraq. Now, this is interesting language because this is reminiscent of Tony Blair's talk of a bridge. Tony Blair used to talk about how he could act as a bridge between the United States and Europe. Chris Mayer, Britain's former ambassador to the United States, mocked that and said the problem with bridges is that they can collapse. Now, Gordon Brown isn't using the same language or the same analogy as Tony Blair, but he's certainly adopting similar thinking, saying that Britain, because of its historic special relationship with the United States and as one of the largest members of the Europe, can act, if you like, as the go-between. This is a very different tone to the tone the Prime Minister adopted when he first visited President Bush last summer, a rather stilted meeting at the White House, where he clearly wanted to put some distance between himself and the White House, the current White House, to show how different he is to Tony Blair. But in his interview with the CBS, warm words for President Bush, and particularly warm words for the three presidential candidates. He's looking to the future, and he's looking to act as the go-between between them and the 26 other members of the European Union.
And on the home front, Nick, Mr. Brown was having a bit of a rough day when he departed. Is this a bad time for him to be going away?
Well, it's always tricky for prime ministers and indeed leaders of the opposition. Let us not forget David Cameron, who's now riding high in the polls, got into terrible trouble last summer when he visited Rwanda during the floods in Britain when he was struggling in the opinion polls. Yes, it's not great for Gordon Brown at the moment. The House of Commons is in recess. MPs come back next week. And they're very, very worried on a number of issues, particularly the abolition of that 10p starting rate of tax. So if he had to go away, well, best to go away in a recess. And as some sort of wise Labour heads are saying is, yes, we've got local election campaigns. Yes, it's looking tricky. But, hey, he's the Prime Minister and you've still got to be Prime Minister. And one of the things Prime Ministers have to do is they have to meet President and future President of the United States.
And you can read more about the Prime Minister's visit to the United States on guardian.co.uk. Also online today, art to make you hungry. See Andy Warhol, Banksy and others in a whole new light. That's at guardian.co.uk/food. And it may not feel like summer, but it's the first day of the cricket season. You can read all about proceedings at the Oval at blogs.guardian.co.uk/sport. And as the mayoral campaign heats up, there's a lot more to London transport policy than bendy buses and Oyster cards, says Christian Vollmar at commentisfree.guardian.co.uk. A UN body yesterday emphasised the need for urgent and comprehensive action to avert a global food crisis. Much has been heard in recent days about riots breaking out in countries from Egypt to the Philippines because families can no longer afford to feed themselves. Environment editor John Vidal talked to Professor Robert Watson, DEFRA's chief scientist, who is also assessing the situation for the UN.
It's clear that our agricultural sector today has had huge successes in increasing production, but it hasn't reached everybody. It means that we haven't necessarily put the right science and technology to the poorest of the poor. We haven't necessarily done the right... And our trade regime has disadvantaged some of the poorest of the poor. So we've got some major successes of increasing food production per capita and absolute, but clearly we have not achieved our goals, and therefore we have to re-examine why have we not reached the poorest of the poor. And I think it means that we've got to have far more participatory research between the small farm, the small scale farmer and university academics, government lab scientists. We've got to check and see why our trade regime is not meeting the needs of the small farmers.
What about biofuels? Are they partly responsible for the problem?
They could well be part of the recent, very recent. They're not the reason we have 850 million hungry people. We've had that for the last decade or so. So I can't attribute directly. But if we start to use more and more land for biofuels and it were to be a cause of food price increases, it clearly will lead to hurting our challenge of hunger alleviation and poverty alleviation. So we have to examine the biofuel issue very carefully to make sure it does not exacerbate two very important development challenges of poverty alleviation and hunger. And if using, say, wheat, for example, maize, were to push up food prices, it could adversely affect both the hunger targets and the poverty targets.
And where does biotechnology fit in?
Biotechnology is a very broad term. The only part of biotechnology that's really controversial is transgenics. I think the first question we have to ask is, you know, if you're a small-scale farmer in Africa, are transgenics the only answer? And the answer is no. There are if they had access to the best seeds, access to nutrients, access in some cases to other inputs such as water for irrigation, they could significantly increase their productivity. Could the form of biotechnology that's controversial, transgenics, play a role? Yes, it could potentially play a role. We are going to think through how can we increase productivity, how can we have more temperature or drought tolerant or pest tolerant plants, and biotechnology, even modern biotechnology such as may play a role. So we've got to continue doing research, but we must ask ourselves the question, what are the risks and benefits? And it needs to be sort of, it has to be nuanced. We have to ask it in specific systems. We have to ask, is it publicly acceptable? Who benefits? Is it the farmer? Is it the seed companies? Is it the consumer? So I believe we should continue to invest in all forms of biotechnology, but make sure we ask the questions about the risks and benefits on a case-by-case basis.
Coming up on Guardian Daily, an ordinary boy taking an extraordinary talent in his stride.
It's really weird because you just think that you're normal and you've just been to a diving competition. I've just been to a diving competition. Normally, I just think it's like in my own little world, I don't know that everyone knows about it.
But first, a court began hearing yesterday how two men tried to blackmail a member of the royal family, who can't be named for legal reasons, with claims he had performed a sex act on another man. A jury at the Old Bailey heard that the two tried to extort £50,000 from the royal after trying to sell the material to newspapers. The case, involving hours of video and audio recordings, is extremely unusual, as our correspondent Stephen Bates explains.
Well, it's pretty unusual for a member of the royal family to get involved in a court case, and it's a very long time indeed, I think over 100 years, since a member of the royal family has been involved in a blackmail case. But the royal family seem to be popping up quite a lot in various courts at the moment, with the Diana inquest last week and now this one starting today.
And how damaging could these recordings have been had they entered the public domain?
Well, it's very hard to tell. The recordings themselves do not directly show a member of the royal family. They're recordings of interviews and talks and ramblings by an associate of the particular member of the royal family involved, largely when he was drunk or under the influence of drugs, and chatting about his resentments and various incidents he says he saw taking place. But there is no direct evidence that the member of the royal family was involved, or indeed that the allegations are true.
There were several hours of this stuff, weren't they? So how were they obtained, and how were the two defendants defending themselves?
Well, there are 8 hours of these tapes, which were recorded over a period of weeks and months, I believe, at the start of last year, by two men who knew this business associate, didn't like him and wanted to get back at him. That's the allegation that's been made in court today. They recorded these, presumably at some stage saw that they had possibly a commercial value and hawked them around various tabloid newspapers and Max Clifford, the media fixer, none of whom touched the story. It was at that point, after they'd not received any remuneration or publicity from the newspapers concerned, that they then approached the member of the royal family more or less directly, dealt with his private secretary and a lawyer friend of his, made a number of claims and allegations, and wanted money in the end.
And how long would you expect this case to continue?
It's scheduled for 4 weeks.
This week's Italian election didn't only return Silvio Berlusconi to the office of Prime Minister for the third time, it also redrew Italy's political landscape. The far left was wiped out, and there were strong gains for right-wing parties, as John Dennis discussed with Rome correspondent John Hooper.
This is a terrible blow for Italy's left. How do you account for this victory for the right wing in Italy?
I think there are several factors. First of all, their candidate, Walter Veltroni, just didn't break through. His rather bland manner didn't play well with the electorate, and he failed to make up the ground that he'd hoped to, particularly in the last few days of the campaign. That said, the poor man had an almost impossible task. His party had only just been founded by a union of the Progressive Christian Democrats and former communists. And he had the legacy of the government of Romano Prodi, which had made itself extraordinarily unpopular with Italians by putting up taxes, clamping down on evasion, and I think it's fair to say also mismanaging many of the issues that came its way during the less than 2 years that it was in office.
Well, Berlusconi's inherited a lot of problems, some of which you've just mentioned, but Italy's the fourth largest economy in the European Union. How does his government intend to revive the economy?
Well, he says that what he's going to do now is to embark on a programme of cutting taxes while at the same time boosting infrastructure spending. And so that there's not a hole in the public accounts, what he intends to do is to embark on a massive programme of asset sales and also, he says, cut down on the size and the spending of the public administration.
Guardian Daily. News and reports from around the world.
You can't be serious, man. You cannot be serious!
The unmistakable voice of John McEnroe complaining yet again about a line call at Wimbledon. And it turns out the petulant player may have had more of a case than we thought. Professor George Mather of Sussex University has been analysing line calls and comparing them with what players thought they saw. Our science correspondent James Randerson explains.
Well, a researcher here looked at those decisions in professional tennis matches on the ATP Tour where the players had challenged what the line judges had called. And they looked at 1,473 challenges in all from 15 different tournaments. And they were trying to work out, you know, what happens, you know, how close to the line is it when these challenges are made and how many times do the officials get it wrong, that kind of thing.
And do the findings mean that these disgruntled tennis players that we see cursing and so on the tennis court have more of a case than we might have thought?
Well, of course, when, you know, the McEnroes of this world were shouting and screaming or, about the umpires being the pits of the world on centre court, there was they didn't have the same kind of technology. Of course, now you've got Hawkeye, which is this setup of cameras that allows you to follow the 3D trajectory of the ball and work out when it's in or out. But yes, it certainly does show that it's worth challenging. I mean, in 39% of the cases where there was a challenge, the official actually got it wrong. So, you know, there's a good proportion where they're getting it wrong. And the researcher kind of extrapolated from that figure to all of those cases where the ball is within 10 centimetres of the line in a match. And he reckons that around 8% of the total judgments are wrong. So it's certainly worth having a go.
So if this is publicised widely, do you think that more tennis players will be having a go at the line calls this summer?
Well, maybe so. I mean, the way the rules stand at the moment, you only get two challenges per set. So you've got to be a little bit careful. It's only worth making a challenge if you really think that there's a dodgy call. But, you know, if you're coming towards the end of the set and you haven't used your challenges, it's definitely worth having a go.
He's 13 years old and already completely relaxed in media interviews, not to mention seemingly relaxed about going to the Beijing Olympics this summer. Apart from his phenomenal diving ability, Tom Daley, European diving champion, seems to have remained an ordinary boy. as sports correspondent Donald McRae found out when he went to meet him in Plymouth.
It's been very hectic, but I've enjoyed every moment of it. Like all the media stuff, I really enjoy doing it. I like when we get to travel up to London for the day. I quite enjoy it to get away from Plymouth and go out to London and have a fun day out.
But I guess it's kind of weird when you see I saw a post of you the other day in some sort of magazine, like a pull-up, glossy colour photo of you.
Yeah, that is weird to see. Like, because normally it's like I used to pull out pictures of athletes instead of, but now younger kids will be seeing my picture in the thing. It seems weird, but it also almost feels like all the hard work that I've put in and all the like sacrifices that I have had to make has like finally become worth it, and I'm finally being rewarded for what I've done.
So you're more famous in Beijing than Plymouth?
I don't think so. I get recognised quite a lot in Plymouth, which has been very weird. Like people coming up to me and, "You're the diver, aren't you?"
So it's just like if you go to movies with your mates, do you?
Yeah, you get recognised, and it's really weird because you just think that you're normal, and you've just been to a diving competition. Like, yeah, I've just been to a diving competition. Normally, I just think it's like in my own little world. I don't know that everyone knows about it. Lots of people change towards me. Like people at school, they come up to me a lot more often, and like since the European Championships, I think I get a lot more mick taking and.
Because you've had some mentally challenging times, and in Germany, you were about to do a competition.
Yeah.
And then you decided to pull out because you were a bit anxious about two of your days. Could you talk about that?
Well, 2 weeks before I went to that competition, I hit the board, I landed flat. I was just going for a really bad patch. I think it was because I'd grown quite a lot at that time. I didn't know where I was, I didn't know what I was doing. And I just scared myself, thinking, "Oh, I'm up here too soon, blah, blah, blah." And I got to the competition, I just froze, I couldn't do it. And now that I know I've got experience on my side now, and that would never happen again, because I know what I would have to do in preparation in going into the competition.
Keep Britain tidy, a familiar refrain aimed at getting us to put our litter in a bin. But according to the Campaign to Protect Rural England, this just isn't happening. And it's not only individuals who aren't doing enough, but councils as well. American author Bill Bryson, a passionate Anglophile and the new president of the CPRE, told Guardian Daily about the group's new campaign to clean up the countryside.
Hello, my name is Bill Bryson, and I'm here today in my capacity as president of the Campaign to Protect Rural England. And I wanted to talk to you about a brand new campaign that we've just launched called Stop the Drop, which is a big 3-year national anti-litter and fly-tipping campaign with particular emphasis on rural littering. Litter, as you will know already, is a big problem all over the country. But litter that gets dropped in urban environments tends to get swept up. In the countryside, however, increasingly it is being left to accumulate. And we're trying to do something about that. I think lots and lots of people feel very, very strongly that Britain has a glorious, wonderful, lovely to behold countryside, and that it deserves not to be trashed, that it should be treated with respect and kept lovely. So that's the whole idea of the campaign. Everybody knows that it's against the law to drop litter, but what a lot of people don't realize is that it's also against the law to leave litter. Litter that's left to accumulate is actually breaking the law. So if your local authorities are not picking up litter from laybys and roadsides and other public areas, they're actually neglecting the law. Very often they will try to give the impression that they're doing the best they can, but that they have very limited resources. Well, that's not actually an adequate answer. They have a legal statutory responsibility to pick up and keep picked up litter in all environments in which they're responsible for. And for them to say to you that they'd love to do a better job, but they just haven't quite got the funding for it, is a little bit like them saying, you know, "We wish we could get rid of all this sewage. We'd really love to be able to put out all these fires, but we can only afford to do some of them." They're actually supposed to be getting rid of litter everywhere. Not just local authorities, but also, you know, supermarket chains and people who have properties and manage land in any capacity. Network Rail is another great culprit that we will be focusing on. And there's three things in particular we're recommending people do. One is that they take action, that they just make themselves heard, that they lobby their local authorities and just complain and exchange ideas and just help to get this onto the national agenda. The second thing you can do, which is really very helpful, is just pick litter up. If you're out walking and you see a crisp packet, don't turn a blind eye to it. Just bend over and pick it up. If we all picked up a little bit of litter, it would make a huge appreciable difference. And the third thing is then to get involved formally in some way, if you possibly can, perhaps taking part in or joining or even forming a litter group in your own area. But the thing to do in the first instance is go to the CPRE's website, where there's lots of advice and guidance, the kinds of things you can do. It isn't necessary to join CPRE to take part in it. It's really just a place where people who are opposed to litter and want to do something about it can get together and share ideas and get advice on where they can go and learn how to complain more effectively and that sort of thing. So please do get in touch. We'd love to hear from you, and we're very grateful to you for listening to me today.
And that brings us to the end of this edition of the podcast. Don't forget that Guardian Daily is available for download from 7:30 every morning. The producers today were Phil Maynard and Tim Mabey. I'm Belinda Rhodes. Goodbye.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.